first class of the Gita series, The Heart of the Gita. And then some of you were just up at this weekend that we did, a rather remarkable weekend. I wanted by telling you a story about it to answer or to at least address a little bit Cynthia's question. I led a workshop up at our meditation retreat called How to Be Truly Well. There's a couple of people here who were at it. And it was really a remarkable weekend, wasn't it? It's always hard to put these things into words because they sound like just you hear it again, but it was transformed for most people who were there. We had an experience at one point in the weekend where Vidura, long resident light bearer, now teacher, builder, everything from the beginning, came over to do some activities with us called Sharing Nature. I think I've mentioned a man who started years ago. It's called Sharing Nature with Children. A man came in, absolutely ahead of me, but not by much. And I don't think he's forgotten. Grown-up man with the most childlike demeanor because he's not been lost in this duality at all. He remembers who he is, and he is truly a child of the universe. So he started these. He's also, by the way, the man who wrote this new book, which is published called Om. He's all of his life really also tried to share about the sound of Om. And so his book is in there, and I cannot recommend it highly enough, but that's an aside. So he started doing Sharing Nature with Children. Then in the last some years, not many, really has just been doing Sharing Nature. And now he's sharing nature. You don't have to be a child to enjoy his activities. And I said to him a few months ago, I said, this is so embarrassing. I've been part of Ananda since the late 70s. And, you know, I know you've been doing this stuff, but I've never really been involved. And I didn't get the feeling that it was so much here. And he said, no, you're right. He said, 2009, something happened. And, you know, really talked about it sort of dawning on people the depth and incredible experience that is there for people to have if they engage in these activities. Now, why am I telling you all this? So this past weekend, the name of the retreat was called How to Be Truly Well. And what that means in our language, I call it that because when you put on a retreat called How to Be Truly Well and you happen to be a physician and it's in this beautiful outdoor retreat, people want to come. They probably come because they think they're going to learn how to fix everything about themselves like that weekend. But it's true. You know, when Yogananda basically told me to go to medical school, and I really always get why that MD is an enormous tool. It works. So a lot of people came to this retreat. We sort of had this sellout crowd and a lot of people we'd never met. But in our language, and we all know this, truly well means what we were talking about before. How do we get centered in our spine? How is it that we actually move away from sense pleasures? And how is it that we quit being drawn over and over? As we say in our Festival of Light, every week we say, even though repeatedly we lost everything we had, repeatedly means millions of lives, but still we come in, all of us. It's just simply the nature of who we are. Even those of us who are trying very hard, every once in a while we get tugged, thinking if we have a little more of what we already have materially, we'll be happy, or whatever it is. You know, I've said this many times. We get fooled into thinking that we really need something outside of ourselves to be deeply contented, at peace. And we're here studying the heart of the Bhagavad Gita to remind ourselves, just for 4 little weeks, that everything we need to be well is already inside. So Vidura took us out to do some nature games, and he did a couple, which I think raised all of our consciousness. It got us in touch with the fact, the last game he did before the experience I'm going to tell you, they're not games, they're activities, is you work in a pair and somebody's behind you and you're just looking. Now it happens to be gorgeous up there. There's mountains, there's valleys, there's all different kinds of trees. It's exquisite. There's a garden at the meditation retreat that is, it's astral. That's all I can say about it, is astrally beautiful. And somebody stands behind you and your eyes are open, and they say, I am, and you say anything, the wind on my skin, I am the acorn lying on the ground, I am the mountains in the distance. You just go on and on, and you do that enough, you get into that consciousness where just a little trickle comes in. You remember, those are not just words that most of our minds won't let us get by. What does it mean if I say I'm the acorn? You know, for 99.8% of my life, doesn't mean anything. But in those moments, you remember it is, in fact, the truth. We are one with that acorn. And it's an optical delusion of our consciousness that you've all heard me say, because Einstein said that we think we're separate, we're not separate. Well, you do a few of these activities, you start remembering. Then he says to us, now I want you all to sit down. There's 23 of us. We're in a little clearing in the woods. Choose a word, any word that comes to mind, and write the word horizontally, and write a poem. Each line of the poem or a phrase of the poem will start with the letter of the word that you've just done. Now, I'm up there, and I'm the leader of this group, right? So I'm telling myself, I never like to do these things. I don't know if I'm going to write the poem. And I'm sort of standing up, wandering around. And really, divine intervention said to me, write a poem, Shanti. So I wrote a poem. I chose the word expand, and I wrote a poem with E-X-P-A-N-D. So after about maybe 15 minutes at least, maybe even more, he said, okay, we'll come back together now and we will have our leader read her poem. So here's what I want to tell you. I read my poem. I've never written a poem before. And honestly, the poem was beautiful. It was perfect. Then everybody wanted to read their poem, so he was very smart, breaking the ice, if you will, and everybody's poem was exquisite. Everybody's poem. And that night, I was staying in a house with Suman, who some of you know, a woman who's very much a part of our temple, and her mother, who's at least in her late 70s. And Suman and I stayed up late, and before I know it, Suman has these tears streaming down her face. And she's describing to me what we all experienced, but she's putting it into words so exquisitely that somehow we were led. Now, of course, this was late Saturday afternoon, so we had all already been together Friday, all day Saturday, and we packed a lot in. We were very together, and we were very uplifted, and we were centered. In just that short time, it's remarkable. Time became an illusion. It didn't matter. But she said, we were living in a different state of consciousness. We were living in a super conscious state when Vidura had us doing that. So while everything else was still going on down here, everything, we were up here. And it's just like you climb a mountain that's 5,000 feet up, and you're up there, and it's quiet, and it's beautiful. And you look down, and you see a village down there. And you know in the village, everything's going on, everything. People are shopping. People are at home. They're cooking dinner. Some are making love. Some are fighting. Kids are screaming. Kids are nagging their mother, driving them crazy. There were a lot of mothers there, of four-year-olds, five-year-olds, six-year-olds, saying, but what do I do when I go back to my children? What do I do when I have to go back to work? When you're up on the mountain looking down, it's so quiet. It's so peaceful. You would have to remind yourself that that's what's happening because you are on the mountaintop. And the more we take ourselves to that super conscious place, the more we do that. And yes, of course, ultimately, this is always the punchline, it's all about meditation. The final stretch, it's got to be about meditation. But there we were. We were having talks. We were doing hatha yoga. We were chanting. We were definitely meditating twice a day. Mangala came and gave us a talk, a beautiful talk, on affirmations and how to use them in our lives. Vidura took us out into nature and took us to a transcendent place. And it changed our reality. Now, those are all my words, but Suman had started that about 5 minutes back. And then she said, nobody would have thought to say a bad word. Nobody would have said anger or fear. I mean, they're not bad words, but nobody. It didn't dawn on us because consciousness in love, in that place that we all want to live in constantly, you can't feel those things. You cannot be transcendent. You cannot be in a super conscious state and feel fear because you're in love. You're in joy. You're feeling your power. All of those things, that all of those eight attributes that many of us have been hearing about, they cancel out completely. It's not like love, joy, I'm sad. Then we don't feel nagged by work. The kids still need us, but we have our kids get up and say, what are we going to do now? Let's stand here and say, I am awake and ready with your 4-year-old and your 5-year-old. You start teaching them children's affirmations. You help them. They're closer to super consciousness than we are, you know? So you help them remember who they are. Now, I completely agree with what Biraj said and what everybody said. Would that we could always be there. But that's our goal. And I think the answer to the question, or at least one answer to that question of how do we get there, how do we stay there, is we have to keep practicing. We have to keep practicing so that when it comes to you like it did to me, 5 o'clock Saturday afternoon at the retreat that I'm putting on, 25 people there, that I forgot to arrange for lunch on Sunday, so everybody's going to be really hungry, and there's no lunch, and there's no food. Now, it sounds silly, because I'm up here telling you, and I'm obviously okay. But how do we think most people would have responded to that? Oh, my God, what am I going to do? I mean, you could just imagine. I sat there, and I said, called Supriya, and I said, Supriya, we have a little problem. How are we going to solve this? And we went back and forth a little bit, and I said, no, it just came to me. I'm going into town. I'm buying eggs, bread, cheese. I'm making egg salad, cheese sandwiches. We're going to have a picnic after Sunday service. Better than lunch in that noisy EL. Now, it's a silly example, but many of you have been in my classes. Many of you have heard sermons. I have many examples that are not silly, and we all do, perhaps, where the more we practice these teachings in all these different ways, the more we're right there, and we can say, wow, I wouldn't have known to react that way before. Maybe not last week in some circumstances, maybe not months ago, maybe not 3 years ago, maybe not even 15 minutes ago, but somehow right now, it became a fun problem to solve. And there were Tricia and I at 4:30, she's picking me up at 10:05 in the morning from where I was staying, and we had an extraordinary experience. Truly, I mean, it sounds crazy, and I don't want to spend the whole time there making egg salad and cheese sandwiches at 4:30 and 5 in the morning. You know, it's just, it's hard to describe where these teachings go. I had to go down to the temple, which is about a 5-minute walk from the dining room, to get set up for our morning sadhana that was going to start at 6:30. And I had to go make sure everything was ready. And I started the way I would if I were making rounds in the hospital, like a purpose, I have a goal, I got to get somewhere. I said to myself, wait, if you think you're just getting to that temple, you'll miss everything between here and the temple. And I had an experience of where I think Bharat lives because I remembered to say to myself, be here now. I looked at a tree, I felt one with that tree. I literally walked in the kitchen. Tricia said to me, it was like, what happened to you? Where are you? I mean, it was obvious. So it's hard to say. You know, I kept reminding the people at the workshop, and I'll say it now, when we were talking then about how to be truly well, but that's what the goal is in the Gita. It's the same thing. Everything we're doing that is spiritually oriented, anything, anytime we hear a talk, anytime we take a walk and we remember to do it consciously, anytime we talk to our kids and we do it consciously, anytime we're sitting in this class, we're on our way. And slowly but surely, we get to that place where we're there. And until we get to that place where we're there, this lifetime, next one, 100, who knows, we start experiencing more and more often right in this life, right now, wow, I was just okay. I didn't even have to forget and then remind myself. So I wanted to say that. Somebody said to me, just inside, walked up to me and said to me, "You're so little." And I said, "I never feel little. I don't feel little. I've never in this life felt little." And it reminded me of a story that I think it was Swami Shankara, but I don't know who the saint was, but I think it was him told this story, that there was a lion who was raised by a flock of sheep. And so it grew up believing that it was a sheep. It really believed that. And when a lion finally saw him and came over to him and said, "Why are you behaving like the sheep?" And he said, "Well, I am the sheep." And the lion said, "No, you're not. You're a lion." And he said, "I'm no lion. I'm a sheep." And the lion eventually had to take him over to a pond. And he looked and he saw he was a lion. And I'm saying it to you because if we live in terms of our limitations, we get to live with our limitations. If we live in terms of what we can plug into moment by moment when we're making conscious effort, then we live in terms of that reality. And the truth is, although it's hard, we live there, no matter what's happening in this world. Because what we hear at the beginning of this beautiful, I didn't even bring the big book, but the interpretation of the Gita that Swamiji did, really Yogananda's interpretation of the Gita, is that it's all about our state of consciousness. Nothing really changes ever, not from one life to the next, not over millions of years, not in this lifetime. Nothing changes except our consciousness. And if we keep working to expand our consciousness, then soon we just find ourselves there. That's the book. Beautiful book. That book, if anybody hasn't read it, you pick it up, it reads like a novel or something simple. You can't believe that what's being interpreted for you is this extraordinary work. Now, I have to say, I love what Biraj did, because even the way you read it, Biraj, even the intonation, made it so accessible in a way that the Gita usually is not. Most of us would sit down to read the Gita, or the Bible for that matter. We can't read this stuff on our own and know what it means. And so one great soul after another has interpreted it. But what Yogananda said about his interpretation of the Gita is that his teacher, Sri Yukteswar, would never let him read anybody else's interpretation of the Gita. He just said, never read another interpretation. When he sat down to write this, now this is Swami Kriyananda's, he remembered really what Yogananda said to him, but he wrote it, and he wrote it, I'm sure, even that next degree that we could understand it. He said, "I finally realized why Master was never to read another interpretation, because Sri Yukteswar did not want him to be biased. He wanted him to go inside and attune himself completely to sage Vyasa and take it directly from Vyasa, who is the author of the Mahabharata and the Gita." You know? So I'm going to back up now. So what we have here is this extraordinary work that really everybody who's serious about leading a yogic lifestyle, becoming a yogi, one of the strongest lines in the whole Gita is when Krishna looks at Arjuna and says, "Arjuna, be thou a yogi." Those few words, but a book full of an interpretation. What does it mean to be a yogi? On this path, for those of us, and many of you are, who are already on this path, we're particularly attuned to not just the Gita, but to this interpretation, because remember, Babaji, in a previous incarnation, was Krishna, and Yogananda, in a previous incarnation, was Arjuna. So we're already in tune to to some degree here with this writing. So I'm going to just start from the beginning, and in the next hour, just try and lay the story out a little bit for you, starting simply with what you know, and then moving into some of the symbolism. Stop me at any time. Maybe even in about 20 minutes we'll take a break so everybody can get up and move, because it's hard to just sit and listen, and I know that. But we felt like we had to really explain the Gita a little bit first, and I think it's worthwhile. So I'm not going to keep saying, I'm sure you know, I'm sure you know. I know many of you know some of this, but we'll just speak it from the beginning. Bhagavad Gita means song of the soul or song of God. And even when I was thinking about that today, isn't that beautiful, the song of the soul? It just, somehow it just softens us. It just touches our heart in a way. I was thinking when I looked at that of how Yogananda always said chanting is half the battle, and what music means, and how music can come in bypassing the mind, really just taking a detour around it, which it all does. We know that, what a profound effect music has on us. They're using it in operating rooms. Most of us can remember songs from the 60s or the 70s or the 80s, but if you try and remember a mathematical equation from that time, you'd probably have a little more trouble. So there's something about music that carries this into us, and it's just such a beautiful, thinking of it as a song like that is so beautiful. Also, one of the other things that I've noticed from giving some of the Sunday talks, so therefore really focusing on different lines from the Gita, 52 weeks throughout the year, because at our Sunday services, this is what we do. We have a reading from the Gita and a reading from the Bible, in essence, so that Swami Kriyananda could say, look, all these great souls are saying the same thing. Doesn't matter what the language or how many thousands of years apart or two different leaders of what have become two separate religions, what they were saying was the same. And when we read the Gita next to the Bible, what's so obvious always is this incredible softness in the Gita. It's always filled with hope. The aspirations are extremely high, just like we were looking at here the first hour. It's like, really? Every sense pleasure all the time? You know, and it just feels, and of course the whole Gita is like that, because that's where the bar is set. The bar is not set at, do you want to feel a little better? Would you like to be a better person? Would you like to go out and do some nice things? The bar is set at, do you want to remember your divine nature? Do you want to be one with God? And if you do, well, it's just simply not easy. It's a battle, moment by moment by moment. That's why the whole Bhagavad Gita is about a battle, because it's exactly what has to happen for yogis to be thou a yogi. And we can't forget. We can never let ourselves forget that every minute of this life, in some way, it sounds harsh when you say it like this, but it's a struggle for us. We have to be centered and absolutely ready, grounded in our root chakra, being able to be fluid so we can go wherever we need to go, have this fiery determination of the third chakra, who is represented by Arjuna, who is one of two main characters in this whole story. They're going to battle, and that's what we need to do. So it is hard, and yet every Sunday when we read it, I really am just about moved to tears, because it's infused with so much hope all the time. And I have no idea what stanzas Biraj is going to use as we move on. But there are so many, even of the 52 that we read throughout the year, that's saying, look, here's how you do it if you're a yogi. And if you're just not quite a yogi yet, here's how you might do it. And if you're really wanting to be a yogi but you're nowhere near it, here's how you might do it. And if you're even just thinking about it. So Krishna says, if you bring me even a leaf with great devotion, I will accept that leaf, and in that, those words of acceptance mean, I will be right there for you. I will appear to you. I will help lift you up. Bring me so much as a leaf, And all of the way through the Gita, that's what we get. As you read these stanzas, as you think about it, as you're walking around the next 3 weeks, opening your heart, you just watch for that, feel for that. So much hope that says, who cares if it's 5 million years or lifetimes? Who cares? What difference does it make? You know, I've had an experience in this life of having some major part of my life go very differently than I thought it would and that I thought I was attached to then. There's no need to explain it, and in fact, because this is going to be out on the World Wide Web soon, probably better that I don't explain it. But suffice it to say that it's the kind of thing that you dream of for a lifetime, and then it doesn't appear to you. You just realize, well, you know, at this point I'm 65. I mean, I'm closer, way closer to leaving than I am to just starting, so it's not happening. And, you know, probably about 5 years ago or so, it came to me, what difference does it make? That's just some little thing that I thought I had to have this life. It's not coming to me. I mean, with such peace and calmness, that is not always the way. Many of you who know me know it's not always peaceful and calm. But with such peace and calmness, I realized you just thought in this little mind that you needed that to be happy. You are not getting it. What are you going to do? You're going to be happy. You're going to still keep searching for contentment. In fact, you're going to start practicing gratefulness that this life is coming to you just exactly as it should. And that which you thought you needed to be happy, stand still and say, where am I right now? I'm joyful. I don't need it. It's just this, a change of consciousness. You know, Sister Gyanamata, who we know was one of the most highly evolved female disciple of Yogananda. And it's saying a lot, right? It's like, the disciples, that's who some of these people that we mention are, Jesus' 12 disciples, the equivalent. She said in her writing, I'll never say it right now as beautifully as she did, but she said, writing a letter to somebody, I never ask that a situation in my life be changed. I ask that my consciousness be changed so that I can not just accept it, but learn from it, grow from it, see the spiritual opportunity as it. When she said, I never ask, she meant it. That's quite a thing to think about, trying to realize that and to get to that place. So what is it that the Gita is trying to tell us, the essence? And this is where I thought Biraj did such a beautiful job, even with the affirmations of the Hatha Yoga. I don't think I've ever... I love those affirmations. I practice those affirmations. But I heard them tonight as direct teachings from the Bhagavad Gita, direct. And I think they are that, but you put words around it that really held them up there for me like that. So next week, listen to them that way as he's leading you in a few yoga postures. Of course, they're affirmations, which are statements of our highest self. Doesn't mean we're living that all the time. Doesn't even mean in a moment that we necessarily want to do that all the time. If we're in the stage of the revolt, we don't want to, but they're nonetheless true. They are statements of our highest self, these affirmations. And it was so beautiful. So everything here is holding us up with eyes lifted, basically, to that state of superconsciousness, taking us by our hands in this book and saying, just start walking with me. From stanza one, just start coming with me. We're going to teach you how to be a yogi. Now, the Mahabharata is an epic tale, the longest epic that was ever written, and the Bhagavad Gita is a tiny little piece of it. And I'm in the process right now of teaching every other Tuesday for an hour and a half. I teach the Bhagavad Gita to a group of women, mostly Indian women in this group. It's been really wonderful for me because to really teach it stanza by stanza, I mean, you have to study it, which is why I decided that I would be willing to do it. But you should see their eyes light up when they hear some of this because, oh, that's why my mother was telling me that story when I was little, or wait a minute, now I understand. Because they grow up with the stories, but not necessarily the depth. You know, and it can be used against them. If they're not good, you know, the mother will tell them some story from the Mahabharata. Am I telling the truth? Yeah. But to really dive deep into it, and they're having this opportunity to do it, has just been such a joy for them. So what this is, so here we are, I'm sorry, let me go back. So it's a little piece of the Mahabharata. So we come into the story late. When we start the Bhagavad Gita, we come into the story after these two families who have grown up together. Many of you know this, the Pandavas and the Kauravas, and they're basically what they call in India cousin brothers. So they're not just, they don't consider them just cousins even the way we do. They call them cousin brothers. So they bring that term brother in. It really helps us see in this, in our language, how close they are. So they've grown up together, but the two oldest siblings, so Dhritarashtra is the king, but he's blind. I'm going to come back to this, but I want you to see how this gets set up and hear the spiritual teachings behind it. He's blind. So he asks his son, Duryodhana, who represents pure ego, to lead his part of the land. The Pandava brothers, the eldest really of the Pandava brothers, is Yudhishthira. And what happens at some point is that Yudhishthira gets tricked into a game of dice. Now, right away there's a huge amount of spiritual teaching here because Yudhishthira represents the fifth chakra, which is calmness, it's compassion. It's a highly evolved soul. Ether is its element, meaning it's remembered that it's not really bound by the limits of the human body. So he's highly evolved, and he gets drawn in by the bad king, not the king, but the king's son, into a game of dice. And as Swamiji so cutely says, unfortunately for him, the dice were loaded. But you see, in a way, what a beautiful lesson. Two lessons here for us right away, because it's just the way it is in life so often. The dice are loaded. You're sure that you're going in. You're sure you can't be fooled. You're sure you see what's going to happen. But Duryodhana had hired a man to work with him who represents some downward pulling, evil quality, cheating, lying, greediness. I don't remember right now. And he had him load the dice so that Yudhishthira had to lose. So they lose. He loses the dice game, and because of that, Duryodhana says to them, you have to go spend 12 years in the forest, and after those 12 years, so you leave this land. Now these two sets of brothers are about to inherit this land, 50-50, and after 12 years of being in the forest in a way, you have to completely disappear, be absolutely out of everyone's sight, out of mind for 1 year. Then you come back, and then we'll talk about sharing the land. So the Pandavas do it. They figure they lost fair and square. They're highly ethical beings. They represent each of the chakras and all of our upward-moving energy. So they do what's right. They go off into the forest. They spend the 13th year away. They come back. And Duryodhana says to them, no way. And they said, well, you know, we've really learned to live very simply. We'll be happy even with just a little piece of land. And what does he say? He says, I won't even give you as much land as you would need that would cover a straw or a needle. That's interpreted differently, but you get the point. You're getting nothing. And of course he says that, I want you to remember, because he represents our ego. And our ego never wants to let any spiritual reality, anything that's going to try and help us live beyond it. It is the nature of the ego to want to keep control. That's what it does. You can't change the nature of something. So the ego's constantly struggling with us. Should I go to the walk-in meditation on Thursday night, or should I stay home and watch television? Should I get up and be in the temple at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning to join the community meditation, or should I let myself sleep an extra hour? Am I going to go out for dinner with friends, or do I want to come to a class? It's just, it's endless. It's endless. That is the nature of the mind. It literally has a never-ending number of things to do to keep us away from this, from our spiritual calling and inclination. And it's very important for us to hear that, because it's the truth. The only way around it is to transcend it. If you try and bargain with it, this is why Yogananda says a room can be in darkness for thousands of years, but the instant you turn on a light, the darkness disappears, and goes on to explain there's nothing else to do about the darkness. Nothing. You can't reason with it. You can't rationalize with it. You can't beat it up. You can't do therapy with it. There's nothing you can do with it. The only way to dispel darkness is with light. And we're talking now about spiritual lights. That's why he said that. That's why every class I ever teach, I quote it, because it is the essence of our spiritual path. How do we turn on lights? So, of course, Duryodhana, who represents ego, did not want to give any land, no room, nothing that they could get a hold on to the Pandavas. So now they realize they have to go to war. And here we are at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. And then a very interesting thing happens. Arjuna, who represents the generic disciple, disciple every man, I think Yogananda calls it something like that. He's all of us, basically. And Duryodhana get to go and decide who is going to fight with them, how they're going to do this. So it turns out they go in. I don't want to make this story too long because I want to get to the battle, which is really where we're at. But they go and they find Krishna, and Krishna is asleep. And Arjuna, right away, as a beautiful disciple, goes and stays near his teacher's feet. But Duryodhana goes right up at his head, waiting till he wakes up so he can be the first one there. But when Krishna wakes up, he says, look, I woke up from my sleep, and the first one I see is Arjuna. He said, because he's looking ahead. So he said, really, I'm going to let Arjuna pick. You can either have me, and I will come, and I will be with you. But here's the next very important spiritual lesson. He says, I will not fight. I cannot fight your battles for you, but I will be there, and I will be supporting you every step of the way. But I will not raise a weapon. So you either just get me, or you get the army, the whole army, thousands of people in this army. And Arjuna says, without a beat's pause, without a thought, no hesitation, I want you, God. Right away, knowing this very beautiful disciple, I want God by my side. Because he knows, trying to think of the Sanskrit, yata dharma tata jaya. Where there is dharma, where there is right action, there is victory. He wants God there. And Duryodhana is just ecstatic. He's going to get this whole army. And they go to war that way. So in the Gita, it unfolds, the whole Gita unfolds, with Krishna, God, driving the chariot, Arjuna sitting next to him and asking him all of the questions that we'll cover several, many of them, in the next 3 weeks. How do I become a yogi? What are the practices? What do I have to do to get there? In fact, what he says, he basically tells you what you're going to run up against, why you're running up against it, how you can begin to solve it. And basically, Swamiji says right at the beginning of this, he says so many people get lost on the spiritual path wanting to ask the question, why did God make us in the first place? And it's true. Why are we in this? How could this big loving presence, why would he have manifested us and then gone to a lot of trouble to drop this veil of delusion, this Maya, so that we have to be out here in great pain only to spend 10 million lives trying to get back there? You can understand why people would ask that question. Yogananda says, has said in this interpretation, why don't we ask a question that has meaning? Instead of saying why, and we'll probably never come up with an answer that's going to satisfy the mind, right? That's what Buddha says. The mind that asks that question could never understand the answer. He said, let's ask a meaningful question. We're here. This is where we are. This is our condition. What are we going to do about it? Much more meaningful question. So the Gita are all of these stanzas that tell us from beginning to end what it is we are to do, how it is we're supposed to get back on this path, walk our path, and live the way we want to live. And the very first thing that the first thing is when Duryodhana, or Dhritarashtra, who's blind, approaches Sanjaya. He's actually sent to Sanjaya, who represents introspection. And he approaches him, the very first line of the Gita, and he says, and I can't quote it, but he basically says, what happened here? Now, the battle is still going on. The battle is just raging. But he says, so he can't see, what happened here? But he asks introspection. So right away, the Gita, right from the first line, says, the only way to ever know the truth is by using introspection or intuition, is by intuiting it, by meditating on it, and by knowing the truth. You can never really know the truth as it's going on if you use your senses. If you watch the battle as it's going on, you would never know what the outcome's going to be. You can guess, you can wonder, you can try and make educated guesses. Those are all the things that our mind does. But you can't know without approaching introspection and using introspection in a moment what happened here. So right away it gets us on straight onto the path of meditation. Making choices as I go here, that's why all this, like, what do you talk about for the half hour when it's trying to present the whole Gita here, but it's fine. Well, whatever happens tonight will just happen. I wanted to just talk for a moment just a little bit about this, the whole representation of the Battle of Kurukshetra, and of course Kurukshetra representing the spine, which is where the battle is going on. And of course the battle is in each one of us, and it's this constant struggle because we've all been made manifest from this purely divine energy. And as it comes down through the chakras and it goes from ether to air to fire to water to form, solid form, which is what we have here when we look at each other and we look around us, it's what we see. And our whole purpose in life is, of course, trying to really make a U-turn, if you will, spiritually, and come back up the spine, and to be constantly pulling, drawing all of that energy that is out there, to pull it in and up rather than having it go down and out, which is what it does for most people and probably for many of us much of the time. Swamiji has a line here that I wanted to read. He's referring to a line at the beginning of the second chapter of the Gita that says, fight the battle of life or you will acquire sin. That's the line in the Gita. And what Swamiji says about it, and I just wanted to say this to underline this. I was talking before about how life is a continual battle. I think this is part of the whole third chakra and why Arjuna, who represents the third chakra, is the disciple, because it's so hard for us to realize how much power we have to bring, commitment, determination to life, to be able to grow spiritually. It reminds me of when people come to me in my medical head now, and they have a cancer, but they want me to tell them that it's okay for them to deal with the cancer with only alternative complementary medicine, which most of you know I totally support. And I send a lot of people to healers of all different types, and I love bringing it all together. But I say to them, cancer's different. And I really felt this after all these years of practicing. Cancer is strong energy. It's a big karma. And by and large, for most people, in order to let that cancer know that you mean business, you need to, along with all of the homeopathic, naturopathic, healing, all the stuff we talked about in the chakra class that is so wonderful, you may well need a surgery or chemotherapy or radiation, because those are big guns. You have to come at that battle and meet the battle appropriately. And, you know, I mean, I'm not saying people are never healed. Of course they're healed. But very often, I later am called to help those same people die well. You know, people who just wanted to take an herb or wear a color or do whatever they wanted to do for a cancer. Cancer's big. That's the way I feel when I think about this battle that we have to fight. We need to get big energy. So many people on the spiritual, on any spiritual path, feel like the way to be spiritual is to be very sweet and always to give over and everything, and just that kind of energy. But that's not who Arjuna is. That's not what happens to Arjuna. And it's interesting because the Gita is that he's the one who's being taught. He's the one who's being strengthened. Willpower, fiery determination. Swamiji says here, the spiritual interpretation of the above passage, the one I just read, that said, fight the battle of life or you will acquire sin, is that unless the soul battles continuously to overcome the consciousness of the flesh by experiencing soul consciousness in meditation, that soul acquires sin. And what he means by sin is, of course, we're drawn out into the world, drawn by our senses, and live in this material plane. I mean, when you're dealing with your senses, you can only live according to a material reality. None of our senses can transcend the material reality and take us to soul consciousness, because that's not what they do. That's not how they've learned to live or be or interpret things or discriminate. Everything's on a physical plane. We have to find spiritual tools that take us to the top of the mountain that I was talking about before. So I just wanted to say it because in a way we can take that battle. I mean, those are big words, battle and power, and we can turn it into joy. The scene in the Gita where Arjuna gets what's going to go on and he's saying, I can't kill these Kauravas, they're my cousin brothers. I can't kill them. Why would I want to live? I'll have blood on my hands for the rest of my life, is really what he says, literally. I mean, he uses the word blood. I'm not going to live with that consciousness. And they said he throws his bow to the ground. And the bow, of course, represents the spine. And the arrow represents our ability to focus and concentrate. And he just lets it all drop, saying to Krishna, I don't want to fight this battle. And really, symbolically, what he's saying is that every human being comes up against that moment where they say, I don't really know that I want to let go of all this stuff. I don't really know that I want to. I actually really enjoy a little bit of those pleasures, or if not a lot of those pleasures. And I'm not so sure that I want to be all that nice today, right now. I had a man in my office today. I've had to write a whole history and physical of him and send it to specialists because he's having these procedures and I had to clear him. And I wrote at the end of it, this man is a delightful and quirky handful, right in his medical chart, because that's what he is. And he came in today and I was saying to him, you know, don't you see that by behaving the way you're behaving, you think it's just about you, and if you want to behave that way, because he likes to get angry. And he says, I've never hit anybody. I've never hurt anybody. I said, have you ever thrown anything? Well, yeah, I throw it, but not at anybody. I said, what do you think it's like for your wife when you're at home and you're throwing a chair? I mean, you think that doesn't affect her? And he just sort of slumped down in his chair. I swear this is the truth. And like a little kid, he went, I don't want to quit being angry yet. You know, he could see the argument was being made and towards, you know, you're really going to have to quit being angry because they think you're getting crazy because of the drugs you're on. And I'm here to show you, no, you've been this crazy. What are we going to do to help you get rid of it? And, you know, when we use these kind of examples, it seems extreme. But we all do that. We all do a little bit of pouting and a little bit of resisting. So Arjuna throws his bow down. But the reason I'm telling you this whole story again right now is because Krishna basically says to him, Arjuna, don't be silly. Nobody's dying here. Nothing happens. You see your cousins as dying. I see their souls rising. You know, where's the truth here? So what does that mean? Those cousins, every one of those cousins, represent our own inclinations in life. Every inclination that, you know, I say it, it's so linear, the English language, that it makes it sound bad enough that we can all feel excused. But really, if we had any other language to use, so I didn't have to say downward pulling, because those of us sitting in this room, we're not really down people, we're not bad people, but we're talking about every single thing about us that has us doing anything other than focusing on bringing our energy from the medulla, which represents ego consciousness, into this point between the eyebrows, the soul center, Christ, center of Christ consciousness, third eye, all of what it's called, right? To bring it here that represents soul consciousness. That is the whole purpose of life. And everything we do otherwise takes us away. Swami has these beautiful analogies that he uses to show us you just simply can't have it both ways. This is not a proposition that's, I'll have a little bit of this, I'll have a little bit of that, I'll do it this way now, I'll do it that way now. It only works for so long. Fortunately, what starts happening, and this does start happening, probably most of you know this already, you get a little bit more and more and more towards the soul consciousness. And thank goodness we quit wanting some of the other. We don't want to argue as much with our spouses. You know, we find ourselves just sort of opening our heart in those situations a little more. We really don't want to hang around with the same people. We really don't want the same music on. You know, it's funny, I had about four people from my family just stayed with me from Sunday night, right as I came back from this extraordinary weekend. Two of them were actually up there and had profound experiences. Two more joined us. They were in my house staying there. I was with them all the time except to sleep. I would go over to my other house. And every time I walked into the house, I had to say to them, you know, I really need to turn this music off. I hope you don't mind if I turn the television on. And my niece, the younger one, said, you're a grouch. And I thought to myself, I must seem like a grouch to them. But I couldn't, they don't know how generous I was being that they could play their music in there when I wasn't there. Mm-hmm. Because I'm going to come in and feel it later. I know it, you know? I mean, I literally went back there today, I opened all the windows, all the drapes. It's like, I was about to light some sage, you know? I mean, to do anything. But you get to the point where you can't. It's not grouchiness. You just can't be around that music, because you are literally vibrating at a different frequency. Anyway, Krishna says to him, don't be silly. Nothing happens. And Arjuna pouts and fights and comes up with a lot of excuses and a lot of these questions. Swamiji says the reason people keep asking the questions, why is this happening to us, why is this happening to us, is just a way of staying away from what we need to do to put one foot in front of the other on the spiritual path and move forward. And I think that's really right. Because this, why would we be put here to begin with? Who would do that to us if they loved us? Why do we call that divine mother? What mother would ever do this to a kid? I mean, I've heard all this a lot from people who come to talk to me here. But it really keeps us here when we do that. And you become very aware of that energy and that consciousness, as opposed to having solution-oriented consciousness that allows you to get beyond it. When I realized that I didn't have lunch, the first thing I did, I had called the kitchen at the Expanding Light and said, yikes, I forgot to tell you I want to bring 22 people over there tomorrow. This is at 5:00 on Saturday. And he says to me, I can't do that. I've already prepped the meal and, you know, I mean, there's no way that you can come here. It just can't happen. And so I started bargaining with him. How about if I go out and buy the potatoes and bring them to you? And I'm trying to solve the whole problem. And anyway, all of a sudden I said to him, you know what? I'm putting you in a terrible position. This is my responsibility. I forgot to call you. Enjoy your meal. I'll take care of this. But even the next day, somebody came up to me and said to me, I heard what he did, and that was terrible, and he should have. And I said, you know what? I don't want to go there. I really get it. He was doing the best he could do. You know, it was like not living in that consciousness. I can't exactly remember why I was telling you. But boy, that thing about the lunch was a whole host of spiritual lessons, I'll tell you. Now, it really was. It was interesting. And just being able to keep rising above what was going on. There was a part of me that wanted to say, I would have never said no, which is may well have been the truth, but I mean, it's so beside the point. You know, what difference does it make what I would have done? And I probably would have been a nervous wreck about it, wondering if everybody was going to have enough to eat. So, you know, it's certainly not necessarily the better way to go. But anyway, sorry, I don't remember the exact point. But what I do remember is that Krishna is saying to Arjuna, nothing dies. As we let go of each of these qualities, as we begin to let go, as we can, as Biraj said to you earlier, we're all in our own place. We have to figure out where we are on this path and grow from there. As we let go of a little bit of our greediness or a little bit of our judgmentalness, or which that comment of, I would have never said no, is very judgmental. It's immediately putting this other person in a negative light, like he did the wrong thing. And judgmentalness has actually been one of my big issues that I've run up against in this life. Now, all of you know me. I'm not ridiculously, horribly, meanly judgmental, but that's just the point. These things are so subtle. They just wind their way in all the time. How much better it felt to say, you know what, of course, just serve your lunch tomorrow. It's wrong of me to even be asking this of you. This is my responsibility, and we're going to come up with a good solution. That felt so much better than my being angry. That's what I wanted to tell you. And the next day when a couple people wanted to be upset with him, people from the expanding light saying what he should have done, I said, you know, not at all. Let's not even go there because it feels so much better. We're not giving anything up, and we don't have to change any faster than we want to change. But we have to realize that far from killing anything, we are actually giving life to our soul as we kill off these negative qualities. And to really hold that image that Krishna says to Arjuna, you see your cousins dying, I see their souls rising. It's just such a beautiful way to look at making change. And if we allow ourselves to plug into, which is what I'm doing by being able to tell this story, and I'm sure the story of the lunch will follow me into many classes and wherever, because it's one of those very simple things in life. But if you allow yourself to try on, what does it mean to choose the more expansive, more uplifting, sort of higher road each time you begin to get a feeling about this. I want to just switch courses here for the last 10 minutes and talk a little bit more. Now, I've been winding it into this talk as we go about the symbolism in the Gita, a lot of which I've talked about, but it's actually important, and it'll become important as we try and read some of the stanzas, to understand when we say the battle is in the spine and raising energy and trying to move into a soul consciousness rather than an ego consciousness. As you read the story of the Gita to be able to understand the extraordinary symbolism, there's nothing in the Bhagavad Gita that doesn't symbolize something about the soul's journey. Nothing. There's not an animal that's mentioned. There's not a human being that's mentioned. I mean, the chariot represents the body. The horses represent our five senses. The Dhritarashtra, who has a blind mind, they talk about what it means to give power to Duryodhana. Part of his name means reins, like trying to rein in the senses, not in a good way, not the way we think, but keep the senses in control. The symbolism is so extraordinary as you go. And the Pandava brothers, I mean, very importantly, and it'll come out through the Gita, and again, I don't know what we'll touch on all 4 weeks here, but the Pandavas, whose father was Pandu, and I just want to get to about his wives to tell you. Pandu, the father of the Pandava brothers, represents what is called positive discriminating intelligence. So it's pure. It's clear discrimination. That's what he stands for. Then he has these sons with his first wife, who is Madri. This is so fascinating. That's why I'm telling you. It's very fascinating. Madri represents attachment to dispassion. So it's dispassion, which is good, but she's attached to it. So there's a little bit of I left in there. And she gives birth to the first two children who represent the lower chakras. Sahadev, they're twins, and they represent the yamas and the niyamas, which mean the resisting wrong action and holding on to right action is really what they mean. So they're almost like the Ten Commandments, if you will. I mean, really, that's what the yamas and the niyamas are. They're basic spiritual laws. So he gives birth with attachment to dispassion to these first two, earth and water, basically are represented, still form, still I, still where am I standing. Then he marries Kunti, his second wife, who represents dispassion. And with dispassion, she gives birth to Arjuna, who represents the third chakra, this fiery determination. She gives birth to Bhima, who represents the heart chakra, who is really that aspect of us, the opening of our hearts, where we control life force or prana. Swami says here, desires of the man centered in the heart. This is all about what Bhima is. Okay, anyway, I won't read any more of that. And then the fifth child, who I mentioned already, Yudhishthira, who made the mistake of getting into the dice game, but who represents calmness and dispassion. So these characters keep coming back to us as lessons, as figures, as representatives about how to live, their very name. Every time we hear about Yudhishthira, we know we're talking about calmness and dispassion. It's very hard to remember all of these names. Even I've been teaching this for months now, but there's all the D words and all of this, and I have to keep looking at these notes because it's very, very hard. Here's another interesting point. I just make one or two more points and then I'll close. But again, the spiritual lessons that are woven throughout. Dronacharya is both sets of the boys' teacher when they're young. And he teaches them archery, among other things. Archery was the sport of the day. There's a very beautiful story that's been told about he has this archery contest going on, and he has each child come up, and he says, I want you to shoot the head of the bird in the tree. And he asks each child, first child, what do you see? I see a bird. What else do you see? I see the tree. What else do you see? I see all the leaves around the bird's head. He wants him to shoot him in the head, the arrow right through the head. And he says, okay, loose your arrow. But he knows that they're not going to hit the head because they're not focused there. And the second one comes up, and he describes what he sees. And then Arjuna comes up, and he says, what do you see? And he said, I see the head of the bird. What else do you see? I see nothing but the head of the bird. And he knows, of course, that Arjuna, because it's the power of concentration, which is what that arrow in his bow and arrow symbolizes. So Arjuna is really already his favorite student, his best student, I should say, and he considers him his best student. But when it comes to the battlefield and he has to take sides, he sides with the Kauravas. And it's another very meaningful moment in the Gita in terms of a teaching for us, because he knows the power in the power of the boys. What else can I call them? That's sort of silly. Here they are, the chakras, the pandavas, rather. I'm sorry. He knows who they are. He knows what they represent. And yet when the time comes where they're going to battle, he takes the side of the Kauravas. And there's almost a chapter in Swami's book devoted to, plus in other places, what does that mean? What do we have to think about when we think about our habits and where habits tend to go and how they tend to most often pull us into a more contracted, again, downward energy? That if given the choice of having to expand and do something different, and we have a habit developed, that it's going to pull us down. But it, more than that, Swami goes on to explain, because he represents habit. It's not talked about, does he represent all bad habits or what? He just represents habit. And Swami says we have to be very careful on the spiritual path to not count on our habits to take us anywhere in terms of growing, that we have to be discriminating all the time with anything that's become a habit and constantly be looking at it with new, fresh eyes, with intuition, really running it by our intuitive processes, because we can't count on habit not to take us in the wrong direction. Does anybody have any questions or comments? I'm realizing it's getting close to 9, and I want to make sure. There's one other thing I wanted to say to you, and I'm going to stop. This will be the last thing I say. There's many comments in these opening chapters in the book that basically say that this power of wisdom, the divine guidance, is drawn out primarily. We have a line in our Festival of Light where we say this every Sunday about, it's funny, the line in the festival is eluding me right now, but that the power of wisdom is really drawn out by our desperate need, by our calling, that the more we keep affirming that we want to grow, that we want to feel this divine presence in our life, literally all these things that many of us have heard over and over, that we want to be raising the energy in our spine, that we need help moving from the medulla to the point between the eyebrows, that we will, through that power, be able to draw God's grace, and that our actions, our habits, our affirmations, our practices, the words we use, the thoughts we hold, everything has to be constantly affirming that, and then and the divine will ascend. And as I said, we'll read it for the next 3 weeks over and over and over. The Gita continuously reassures us that, as Yogananda puts it, God watches the heart, or that intention on this path is so much what matters. I'm going to stop now. Any comments? Okay, we'll let it rest there for the night.